That is the complete tune that we only heard part of at the very end of yesterday's show. It is called Charlie the Hat by Tom Torino. Tom playing guitar, his son Matt on the fiddle, and J.B. Ferris on the bass. Here on Live and Local on FM 90.9, the show is your connection to local performances. I'm Kevin Kelly. And today, the reason we actually sort of continued with the music with which we ended yesterday is that we're actually continuing the conversation that we had on the show yesterday with recording engineer Mark Rubel. He's director of Pogo Studio in downtown Champaign, has been since 1980. And, there was no Pogo Studio before Mark Rubel, so he's been it for all that time. And he is moving to Nashville, which is quite a big deal for those who know him and have worked with him, and that's a great many of both of those people. He's going to be co-directing a recording academy that's called the Blackbird Academy, an offshoot of Blackbird Studio. And we heard about that on yesterday's show, if you were able to join us. We won't be repeating ourselves, I hope, not much anyway. So if you want to know what we talked about yesterday and you did, in fact, miss the show, you can always find our show on our website at will.illinois.edu, W-I-L-L.illinois.edu. Now, the caveat to that is that it doesn't always go up the same day or even the next day, and in fact, yesterday's show isn't up there yet, but it'll be up there either this evening or sometime tomorrow. And then you can hear all of what we had to say, primarily what Mark had to say yesterday. And here you are now. So welcome back, Mark Rubel.
What a thrill to be back. Thank you for asking me.
Well, I'm glad you find it thrilling.
I do.
I won't ask why, but because I can't imagine it. But I am glad you came back and decided to ask you back because I realized about two-thirds of the way through yesterday's show that there were a lot of other things I've been curious about the art of recording in particular, that we could explore. And, of course, you've made so many records that we had heard, parts of five, something like that, that hardly seemed to do justice, nor will today, for that matter, to all the recordings you've made in the studio, which prompts me to ask, has all the recording you've done since 1980 been in either the present studio or in its predecessor, or do you sometimes use other facilities for any reason?
Well, I've done, being on the faculty at Eastern, I've done a lot of recording in there at Eastern Illinois University in Charleston. I've been lucky enough to do a lot of recording in the facility at the Doudna Fine Arts Center, which is a fabulous place, fantastically equipped and very nice rooms. So I've been lucky to get to do a lot of classical music and a lot of jazz recording and music of every kind, which is, well, it's good for the soul, but it's also good for a recording engineer to be exposed to a lot of acoustic music and a lot of acoustic instruments. And occasionally I will travel to other parts of the country to work on records, Memphis or Nashville or New York City, California once in a while. But by far the preponderance of my work has been at my studio. I'm a little unusual in that way. Many engineers are freelance, and so they move from place to place. And that's nice, but I've always thought of it a little bit as in the sense that maybe a classical violinist would be most comfortable with their own instrument. And I look at the recording studio as being my instrument, and it's so I prefer being in a place where I know instinctively where to reach to get the sound that I'm looking for. And we have a giant arsenal of instruments there. If we're looking for a particular sound, I know how to find it. So I'm more comfortable in my own place, of course.
When you have gone to somebody else's place, for example, out of state somewhere or another, what sort of thing have you been called to do?
Any number of things. One of my favorite projects was getting to work with Toby Twining, who I met when he was a graduate student here at the university. He composes a cappella new music, and much of it in just intonation, meaning it's designed to be perfectly in tune. It's a sort of, I would say, the newest avant-garde or the newest frontier of music, where we've been exploring atonal music for 100 years, and it's almost entirely unprecedented to explore music that is perfectly in tune and just intonation. It goes back a little bit to the Renaissance, but interesting to be able to do things that are new and have never been heard before. So I got to go to New York and record a record with him, which was just a great pleasure, getting to work with amazing singers and his music.
Did you happen to bring anything of his along? We were talking about maybe doing it yesterday, or did I just...
I haven't. We'll have to look through the WILL archives and see what we can turn up.
See what we've got. And how much, if any, well, I'm sure you have done some, but how much field recording do you do? Meaning, instead of bringing somebody into your studio, you go out and record them in their space and then bring it back to do...
Quite a bit. I don't know what the percentage is, but maybe 5% of what we do is going into churches and concert halls or occasionally into rehearsal rooms or living rooms to record people or concerts or clubs and that sort of thing. In earlier days, when there was a WILL TV live series, a sort of local equivalent of Austin City Limits, I was the audio engineer, and that was great fun because we had everybody from the Poster Children, the post-rock band, to Medicare 7, 8, or 9. So a wide variety of music, and that was fun and challenging and generally mixed live. So I don't have a chance to go back and rebalance everything. Have to get it right at the spot. Also, for all the El Nora guitar festivals up to this one, I have been the recording director and recorded the groups from the festival theater. And that's always interesting. It's a different challenge to recording live music.
I wanted to ask you about that. What are some of those? I mean, you indicated one of them, which is that you have to do mixing there. And I guess maybe before you answer the first question, answer this one. What is mixing?
Well, mixing is balancing. And, of course, that's a big part of what an engineer does with the music. We have a microphone on each instrument, typically, and we have to find the right blend and balance, which mostly involves turning things up and down, but we can also find the right timbral blend or tonal blend by equalizing things, or and we can, you know, put them left to right across the spectrum to simulate the experience of being there if that's what we're going for. So that's the idea. In some cases with live recordings, for example, I record all the Amasong records. We record each track separately, multi-track we call it, and then later on bring it into the recording studio and rebalance things after the fact, which is nice because it gives us a second chance to get it right. But much of the recording, for example, I think most of the El Nora recordings, even if we record the multi-track, I generally mix on the fly as it's happening, and that's what we go with. There, the advantages and disadvantages are you don't have an undo switch. If you make a mistake, you just have to keep going. If something goes wrong, you can't walk out on the stage and wave your arms and say, stop the show.
Let's try this again.
I have to fix my stuff.
Yeah.
In the studio, we have a lot more flexibility. But the positive part about it is that you can perform the mix as the musicians are performing. And so you get a little bit more of the arc of the performance and more of the feeling of being a part of it and translating that. And so it's exciting. And you, there's also less chance to second-guess yourself and get too lost in the process. You have to focus on the things that are important, and that's generally what translates anyhow.
You used, I refer to you as a recording engineer. You referred to yourself as a recording engineer. You also just used the term a little bit ago, audio engineer. And I wrote down three terms. Differences between recording engineer, audio engineer, and sound engineer.
Well, I think the differences are open to interpretation. So an audio engineer or a sound engineer, I suppose, would be the same thing. But a recording engineer is a subspecialty, which is to say that there are people who specialize in mixing PA systems live, or mixing for broadcast, or mixing for television, or video games, or film, or any number of other areas. For example, I do forensic audio work. So as a, not specifically as a recording engineer, but as an audio engineer, I will work for usually law firms who are involved in some sort of legal activity revolving around sound, and then I'll do research for them and write reports. So that is the larger sense of an audio engineer. And a recording engineer is the subset that concentrates on recording. And there are many subsets of recording engineers. So there are people who do what I mostly do, which is in studio recording, but there are people who specialize in live recording, film recording. There are some people who only mix records. They don't record them. Somebody else brings them the a hard drive or a tape that has a bunch of different tracks on it, and then they're the one who specializes in this balancing process I was talking about. There's another term, which is something that I also do, which is called recording producer. So there's, and the recording producer is more the equivalent of, say, a film director, somebody who applies their taste and advises the band or tries to motivate them and helps make all the many decisions that go into making a completed recording. So which is the best take? What songs are we going to play? What are we going to add, if any? What are we going to take away? Can we change the arrangement? How can we make it most effective and stay within budget?
So the producer, even if as a recording engineer, you're the recording producer, doesn't necessarily get involved in the recording itself at all.
Sometimes it's the same person. I tend to be an engineer producer in that I would rather not be sitting back in a chair trying to describe the kind of sound I'm looking for. Because I am a recording engineer, I can more easily get at the sound that I have in my mind by applying recording techniques. But there are producers who aren't engineers, and they have the benefit of not having to think about the recording process. They can focus more on the creative process and the interpersonal process, and then they don't have to worry about things like microphone choice or what boxes we're running through and so forth. So everyone has a different style, and especially with recording producers, it's very much about their personality and taste. So the cast of characters that you find in as record producers varies anywhere from the usual sort, which is an engineer who has moved up the food chain, to people who are musicians who've made records and then learn enough about the process that they can guide other musicians through it. And sometimes they're just weirdos or lunatics who have extreme personalities that they imprint onto the process. And I think there are not enough of those left.
The weirdos and lunatics? The
weirdos and lunatics. I think that's where a lot of the extreme music from the 60s and 70s came in, that really was so remarkably individual. And I think part of it was the imprint of people that were really going at things extremely and taking it over the top. It's a little too much, I think, conservatism in the recording process. We just don't, it's all flattened out a little bit. Things are all starting to sound a little bit too much the same for my taste.
You have an example of a weirdo and lunatic that might have influenced a recording we'd all know?
The first lunatic weirdo that comes to mind is a fellow named Roy Thomas Baker, an English gentleman. As far as I know, I don't think he is an engineer at all. He's a producer, but a very extreme character. And because he's extreme and he pushes people and the recording process to limits, and of course in those days people weren't as aware of what the limits might be, and I suppose the limits were a little earlier, but at any rate, he's the guy that produced the Queen records. And he produced the Cars records, and more recently a group called The Darkness, where on some of the songs there are 100 guitar tracks. So that's something that's not representing a band as it might be live. It's taking the process and treating it as an abstract process and pushing it as far as it can go. He also produced records for a local group from here, Starcastle, Matt Stewart being one of the guitar players, and my very good friend Gary Strader was the bass player. I was actually lucky enough to get to produce their last record. And a lot of what he did, I think, was just being extreme. He was wrecking cars deliberately and, just pushing everything to the limit. But that's how sometimes you are able to exceed the ordinary and really make something that's extraordinary and lasting.
The recordings of the groups of which you mentioned, are Queen is the one I'm particularly familiar with, and even own one of their records. And it's the one that has Night at the Opera on mm-hmm. it. And in fact, I guess that's the name of the CD, I think. And that's a pretty extreme piece, I would say. And I've heard that, since I've never seen them live, I have to say it's just heard, that that's nothing that can be reproduced live, essentially, what they did on that record. But they try anyway, although for part of their performance of it, they'll play the recording
mm-hmm.
or something like that.
Which is more common than you might think. There's an interesting dichotomy between live performance and recordings. And there's been an interesting historical shift that's taken place since the beginnings of recording. If you think about the early days of wax cylinders, for example, if anyone was familiar with the sound of an orchestra or a live musician, if you had a musician sitting there and you played the cylinder and you said, which is the real thing? People would say, well, the live group is the real music, and then this little scratchy wax cylinder, that's obviously an inferior replica. Over the course of the ensuing century, the recording technology has grown more capable and more ubiquitous. So if you think about it, of the music and sound that we hear in a day, much of it comes through this audio process, whether it's over a television, a telephone, through a computer, from a stereo system or an iPod or whatever, to the point where people probably hear more recorded music than they do live music. And as the technology has developed through groups like the Beatles or Pink Floyd or someone like that, where they realize that a recording is a different animal from a live performance, and that there's so much that we can do in the studio where we can do something like the Bohemian Rhapsody and have 100 voices or whatever. Through pushing that and through the widespread nature of recordings, there's a reversal has taken place, which is that now the live performance is judged on the basis of the recording. So if somebody goes to see their favorite group and you say, how were they? And they say, oh, it was great. They sounded just like the record. Or they say, well, I don't know. It was kind of weird. They weren't what I expected. Well, what happened? Oh, they played their song. You know that one song, which is the one song that's been hammered on the radio. Okay. And they didn't play it like it goes.
Yeah, like it goes, right.
What do you mean like it goes? Well, you know, like other record. Well, that record is one possible, you know, that's the final product that they chose to use out of probably an infinite number of iterations that went into it beforehand. But there's a certain authority that a recording takes on by the nature of being recorded that makes it seem like the real thing. And then the musicians have to live up to that. And this isn't confined to the world of pop music. In classical music, people don't realize that your average classical recording is probably recorded live, but not in a row. Many of these recordings are heavily edited. So we'll do multiple takes. I mean, we'll get 150 takes of a movement sometimes. They're not all complete takes, but in some cases, I'm editing in eighth notes. Oh, we like the eighth note from take number 72 and so forth. So even a classical recording that sounds very pristine and live and as if it happened in real time is actually heavily assembled and manufactured, which is what it is because it's not a live performance. On the other hand, I think it can give an unreasonable expectation that, well, if you're going to be really good at playing classical music, you would never, ever make a mistake and every note will be perfectly in tune. And even the people who are on that recording couldn't actually play it that way. So it's been an interesting reversal. And so that leads to what you were talking about, which is that you get a group that has 100 voices on their record and a choir and an orchestra. And they spent a year making the record with an army of technicians and an army of musicians. And now they have to go out and play live. And they go, well, gee, we have...
We have five
people. And... but we've got strings and horns and a choir on there. Are we really going to have to hire 8 extra buses and, you know, have a bunch of dry cleaning bills and hotels for the choir robes and the choir members and deal with all their dietary needs so we can have this authentically? And then they say, well, gee, we have it on record. So what if we just press a button on the keyboard and it'll all play back in glorious sound? And then eventually it kind of goes from there where the guitar player says, you know, actually the solo that is played on there was assembled out of 150 takes by a genius with a Macintosh, or we actually hired an old studio person to come in and play that for me. I can't really play that either, but my hair looks really good, so what if I stand on stage and my hair will blow in the wind and I'll make guitar faces? And then you could push the other switch and this fantastic guitar solo will play back and the people will get what they expect, which is it'll be perfect. And then at some point, some of the bands will say, well, you know, if people want to hear the record, why don't we just play the record? And that happens more than you might think.
And they'll essentially lip sync and play air guitar.
That's correct.
So that really does happen.
Absolutely.
With some pretty well-known bands and live performance. That's discouraging.
Isn't it? But not all. And there, I would say there's a return to the quality of live music and of live performance. And you also have to keep in mind that there's so much missing in a recording that's present in a live performance. And I think people are, you know, if you look at just the fortunes of the two industries, the live performance business is still increasing and the recording industry is decreasing. Last week was the lowest point in American record sales ever.
Last week.
So in a way, it shows people's priorities. And but it also may show some sort of a backlash or to what I'm talking about, which is to say that I guess it depends really on the genre. Some people don't care if it's live because the show is really just kind of a spectacle. It might as well be a Broadway or Ice Capades or something like that. And then there are other types of bands that are more about the music, and they will play live, obviously jazz groups, but a lot of popular music groups and so forth. There is definitely a movement back towards real playing in real time.
We're going to talk more about recording a band or a group so that they sound live as opposed to the other way around coming up. I'm talking with Mark Rubel, who is director of Pogo Studio. He is also the co-director of the Blackbird Academy in Nashville, to where he is moving after this week, as a matter of fact. And we're very pleased to have him here on Live and Local yesterday and today to pick his brain and hear about this whole, which to me is a fascinating topic of the art of recording music as opposed to recording a lot of other things. I'm Kevin Kelly. So we have support for our broadcast today from WGLT in Bloomington, presenting their final recycled music sale Friday and Saturday, August 16th and 17th, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., and Sunday, August 18th, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Crossroads Center, Wiley Drive in Normal. More information is available at WGLT.org. We probably ought to hear some music since I made a big deal of wanting to hear more of the music that you've recorded, Mark. And here's one by a group that is local to Champaign-Urbana. They're called the Almost A Quintet. We've asked how they came up with this name, and it doesn't really make sense because they are, in fact, a quintet, at least for this recording. They're led by Dorothy Monterano. This is her tune called Dee's Grace from the recording they made with Mark called Cummin Seed and Peppercorns. Thank you. That was something called Dee's Grace, and I misattributed it to Dorothy Martirano, for whom it was written. In fact, it was written by Armand Baudouin, who's one of the members of the Almost A Quintet. He played cello on that tune, Ricardo Flores on percussion, Dorothy Martirano on violin, Chris Raymond on accordion, George Turner on guitar, and from their CD called Cumin Seed, or Cumin Seed if you like, and Peppercorns. Recorded at Pogo Studios by Mark Rubel, who's my guest on Live and Local here today, here on FM 90.9. And Almost A Quintet, a group that is local to Champaign-Urbana. We were talking yesterday about the wealth of musical riches in our communities, and they're certainly an example of it. You can hear them many number of times at Bouvant's in Urbana, I think is where they most often play now, or some other iteration of their membership, which goes under different names, I think. What for you was interesting about making that recording? I know you said you particularly like it.
Well, everything is the real answer, because they're lovely people, and just the sheer staggering amount of talent in a group like that is a pleasure. And, you know, the beauty of the instruments and the process of getting to work with people that I admire, and to have friendships with such talented, wonderful people. That's one of the greatest benefits of being an arts facilitator. It's been an unalloyed pleasure throughout, and really just another example of, as you say, the incredible level of musicianship here, and the something else that's unusual, which is a high level of community. There are towns where you have good musicians, but they don't really interact. They're not necessarily supportive of each other, and the community isn't necessarily supportive of them. And it's something else that I think is remarkable about Champaign-Urbana. Not only do we have such wonderful people playing music, but they interact so much, and they move from genre to genre. You know, you see any of these players, and they're, you know, playing in different styles of music, in different venues, in different combinations on any given night. And that's fantastic. And when you go to see the shows, as everyone should do, because we have it's a natural resource of Champaign-Urbana. You'll see that much of the audience is composed of other musicians. And that's significant, because it means that people's hearts are in the right place, and that they're supporting each other. They're not competitive with each other. On the other hand, they should all be there, but so should the rest of the community. For some reason, was born without the sports gene, but I'm mystified as to why you would have tens of thousands of people at a football game and not at a Donny Heitler or Dorothy Martirano show. I would think, from my point of view, what you take away for your life from it is far exceeds that.
Well, you and I are on that same page. I didn't get that gene either. And you mentioned Donny Heitler yesterday also. I'll just say, for those who don't know, Donny Heitler is a wonderful jazz pianist who has a weekly gig at the Great Impasta in Urbana, attached to Lincoln Square Mall. You mentioned going out to hear folks live, and obviously you've heard these guys live. Did you, in recording them, attempt to make them sound on the record as they do live?
In a way, although it varies depending on what we're doing. I think the way that I think about recording is that I'm trying to create the experience of being among the group or in front of the group. But where we're placing them and in what situation depends on what we're going for. So, for example, with a symphony recording. I'm trying to create the illusion that you're sitting in the center of a beautiful concert hall, and you're just the right distance away where you hear the hall and you have a balance between all the musicians and you can hear everything. But with a group like this, it's not so much that I'm trying to reproduce, say, a live performance where they're on stage, you're in the audience. To me, it's more of a kind of chamber ensemble or a parlor ensemble where you're kind of in the group or in a smaller room, but it's very intimate and they're just playing around you. So, you know, the funny thing about recording is that it's all an illusion. And so the type of illusion that we're trying to create is very, is one of the things that we have to decide as we go through the process. And I tend to think of sound very visually because I'm synesthetic. And so in my mind, I actually see them in front of me, and I place people in a left to right perspective and a front to back perspective, and then try to have everybody sound as wonderful as possible, have all the balances, both the internal balances and the overall balance as good as possible, and then do things like bring up the solos and so forth.
We were talking earlier about bands that are sort of stuck with their recorded performances as the audience's expectation when they go out and play live. Since the vast majority, if not all of the, whether they're bands or jazz quintets or orchestras or whatever, locally, because they're not wildly famous people, are going to be heard many times by their fans live before they ever get around to doing a record, although more and more people will do a record pretty quickly. How do you feel about when somebody, say a university a cappella group, who sounds one way live, then goes into the studio and records in such a way that the resulting product really doesn't sound at all like they do live? It's a very different sound.
Well, I have all sorts of thoughts and things to say about it. You know, ultimately, if I'm working with a group, I try to adopt their aesthetic. And so if what they want to do is something that's completely abstract or manipulated or unlike what they're able to do live, I have certainly assist them because I'm there without an agenda.
Provided you're not the producer.
Correct. If I'm a producer, I have an agenda and opinion. And I always have an opinion, and I will share it with them, but I'm not going to tell them how I think their music should be. That said, I tend, as far as my own aesthetic goes, what's interesting to me about music is that it's an expression of personality and emotion and spirit. And I like to enhance that as much as possible. And what interests me is the people that are making the music and how they come through it. And what interests me about them is what is most unique about them. And so I like to enhance that and try not to have the recording be a kind of moderating or homogenizing process where we go through with an auto-tuner and we take out all of their pitch inflections, and then we go through with a compressor and we take out all their volume inflections, and then we, you know, take hundreds of takes and cut them together to get a vocal performance that is flawless. I think that's missing the point. I brought a famous record producer named Steve Albini down to talk to my class when I was teaching at Millikan University, and he said something that resonated with me, which was, no one ever bought a record because there aren't any mistakes on it. And to me, I think it's, you know, we don't, well, it depends. I guess that's another parameter that we can set. If it's a punk rock band or they're just a kind of a loose ensemble, if there are a bunch of mistakes, maybe that's perfect. Maybe that's what they are. And for other things, if we're really going to make, you know, for the best technical quality, and we can do that as well. But I really like to see the essence of the humanity left in as much as possible. When we're doing vocals on a pop record, even if we overdub it, I prefer not to record it word by word. I like to do complete takes from the beginning to end, because I think that you can hear in somebody's voice, and as humans, we're all very attuned to other humans' voices. You can hear the strain and the change, and you can hear the emotion of it, and you can hear it come up and down. And those are the things that captivate us and that that we follow, I think, through the process. So you mentioned university a cappella groups. It's very odd to me that the trend has been with something as organic and human as the unamplified, unaccompanied human voice. That is one of the genres that has become the most technological of all. And I think it's because of the advent of home recording. So some university a cappella groups will have a laptop and a microphone, which is a fabulous tool. And then they'll record their group one voice at a time, and they'll run it through this thing called an auto-tuner that makes them perfectly 100% in tune without any inflections at all. And then they'll, you know, magically, technologically add an octave below or an octave above. And it just comes out sounding like robots. There's a market for robot sounds to some extent, but to me, it's very unmusical. And so I feel lucky that I've been able to do more a cappella recording recently, and that the groups have been willing to let me talk them into singing live around a microphone.
And we have an example of that.
We do. This is The Girls Next Door. And this song is, one of the things that's interesting about this song, it's a cover of a pop hit by a guy named Gavin DeGraw. And now when I'm hanging around Blackbird, there he is. So it's sort of interesting to...
Blackbird Academy, where you're teaching.
That is correct, in Nashville. So, but this is a lovely version of it. And it is a live performance. We have multiple microphones so we can rebalance things. But I'm very happy to see us get back to that, because to me it captures what's intriguing and enchanting about music.
From the University of Illinois, The Girls Next Door, as recorded by Mark Rubel at Pogo Studio. You're hearing them on Live and Local on FM 90.9.
That's where I have to go to see your beautiful face anymore. I stare at a picture of you and listen to the radio. Hope there's a conversation. We both admit we had it good, but until then it's alienation. I know that much is understood, and I realize if you ask me how I'm doing, I would say I'm doing just fine. How will I say that you're not on my mind? But I go out and I sit down at a table set for two, and finally I'm close to face to you. No matter what I say, I'm not over you. Not over you,
not over you.
Damn, boy, you do it well. And I thought you were innocent. Took this heart and put it through hell. But still, you're magnificent. I'm a boomerang. Doesn't matter how you throw me. Turn around and I'm back in the game. Even better than the old me. But I'm not even close without you. If you ask me how I'm doing, I would say I'm doing just fine. How will I say that you're not on my mind? But I go out and I sit down at a table set for two. But I go out and I sit down at a table set for.
The Girls Next Door from the University of Illinois is recorded in Pogo Studio by Mark Rubel, who's my guest on Live and Local today. And it's, you know, I think we share an opinion on this recording a cappella groups. It's nice to hear a vocal percussionist sound like a human vocal percussionist imitating bass and drums or some other rhythmic device rather than somebody who ends up sounding exactly like bass and drums once they've been auto-tuned and enhanced, et cetera, et cetera. I'm Kevin Kelly. You're invited, if you like, to take WILL, including Live and Local, anywhere you go now. All you have to do is get the new WILL app. If you have an iPhone, iPad, or Android, you can do it. You can find it by going to the App Store or Google Play. Just is simply called WILL Radio. That's how you find it. Visit our website at will.illinois.edu for more information. Yesterday, towards the end of the show, when we determined that you were going to come back today, I put out a question to the audience, the listening audience, saying if anybody had any particular questions about recording for Mark, please drop me an email. And one person did so. And here's his question. He said, I wanted to know if you have ever recorded the pipe organ, and if so, how do you manage such a broad spectrum of sound and pitch extremes?
It's an excellent question. Pipe organ is a fantastic instrument, of course, and it's it does cover essentially the entire audible range. Jean-Paul Bazar here in town builds fantastic pipe organs, and early on, I had the wonderful job of going out and recording some of these, and I think one of them had a 36-foot pipe or 32-foot pipe on it. So that would be, you know, subsonic. It is difficult because they are dynamic in terms of their volume. They get loud and soft. And also, the pipe organ really is an instrument that is part of a system, the system being the pipe organ and the room. So how do we do it? We use very good microphones that are full quality, and we make sure that we're not too close to them. You know, you don't mic the pipes. We're actually partway out in the room, and it depends on the room and how live it is and how good it sounds. From there, I will usually use relatively standard classical music recording techniques, which involves mainly a pair of microphones, a pair of very high-quality microphones. Why? Because we're simulating what it's like to be in the room with a pair of very high-quality transducers that we call our ears. So where they're placed and how is partly a matter of taste, but it's mostly a matter of listening. So the front-to-back distance determines how much of the room we hear. The elevation can change the balance between the low frequencies and high frequencies just depending on where they're located in the room. And sometimes we'll manipulate it. Some of the pipe organs I've recorded around here, the instrument is nice, but the room is pretty dead. Somebody's carpeted it, or it's just not very big. And so often we'll bring it back to the studio and we'll use artificial reverberation to make it sound as though we're in a bigger room than it started. I hope that's a satisfactory answer.
I had another recording engineer in town tell me once regarding a group I conduct called the East Central Illinois Youth Orchestra that a particular place where we had performed, where we had never performed before and hadn't been performed there since, is a very dead space. So from the audience's point of view, it was awful. And his comment to me was that he loved it because he could make it sound however he wanted now, or something to that effect.
Yes.
Legitimate comment about a dead space, or does that really depend on the music?
Well, that's that is one approach, and it does give more flexibility because the opposite is not true. If we record in an overly reverberant space, the only thing you can do is move the microphones closer where you hear more of the instrument and less of the room. I guess I tend to be a little more organic in my approach and try to capture what's there. But, you know, there's been an evolution of recording spaces, especially for pop music. During the 70s, when artificial reverberation became more available, a lot of those studios were incredibly dead. The walls were all fiberglass, and the rooms were unbelievably dry and dead. And yes, that gives more flexibility from the recording, but they're not fun places to perform in. You get no feedback, you get no excitement, because you can sing loud and it's just swallowed up. You can play and it just you know, feels like your energy is going away and not coming back to you. So there's a certain extent to which the room is a kind of a feedback system that feeds excitement and energy back to you, almost in the way that an audience does. So, for example, Pogo is actually a fairly live room for being the kind of multi-purpose room that it is. There's a lot of wood and a lot of reflective surfaces, and that's because I'm trying to create a kind of upward spiral of energy and positivism where if somebody's playing there and it sounds great to them, they will play better and then they'll get excited and then it'll sound better and they will spiral upward, as opposed to, you know, if they're playing, it's also one of the ironies of a lot of expensive recording studios. They have a fancy room and a fancy mixing board and a fancy couch, and then they have a crummy headphone system, which is the most important part of the entire studio because that's the musician's interface with their music. So if they're playing and it sounds bad or distorted or small or weak, that's depressing, and then they play less well and they can spiral downwards. So I think that the space that we're in is important to the performance and how it all comes out in the end.
We have a woman named Ashley Riley. Tell me about Ashley Riley.
She's a very talented singer-songwriter from Decatur, Illinois. I've gotten to work with so many wonderful people. I think I've made more records with David Howie than anyone. We've made something like 25 CDs together, children's records and so forth. I brought this Ashley record. It's a mostly acoustic recording. There's an electric guitar in the background. It's run through a very bizarre piece of equipment called a Telray, which is it's a kind of echo device that uses a spinning can of oil to generate echo. It's a very strange thing, and if you take it apart, there's this little arm spinning a can around. It's quite odd and mad scientist-looking, but it gives an odd pitch-modulating kind of underwater-sounding echo, which I thought was right for this song.
And the song is?
This song is called The Deep End.
Apologies to Ashley Riley for shortchanging her song a bit. At least we got to hear both some of her talent and also that curious sound that you were describing, Mark, which actually I didn't hear so well. We were mostly listening through our speakers, and I didn't hear it until I put the headphones on, since you were talking about headphones, and I guess these are pretty decent. Mark Rubel's my guest on Live and Local. He is Pogo Studio in downtown Champaign, where that was recorded, and he is the co-director of the Blackbird Academy in Nashville, to which he is moving, I think, on Sunday. And so we're sort of getting his last radio hurrah here anyway. And I had a really, if you can answer this question really fast, this is one I wanted to ask for sure, and that is, there's the notion of mastering a recording, and usually, as I understand it, mastering is not done by the person who records it.
That's correct. Mastering is a kind of final polishing process of the recording where we send the finished mix to a specialist engineer who just, as I said, is the quality control person. So if it's too dull, they brighten it up. If it's too quiet, they make it louder. And the reason that it's a bad idea for us to master our own recordings is that we will have more of a likelihood to amplify our mistakes as opposed to save them. So we just want to get somebody else's perspective. What I say about mastering is mastering your own recording is a little bit like giving yourself a haircut. Well, we all have the tools, but we don't necessarily want to live with the results.
Okay. Well, that's about as short an answer as we can get on a rather complex subject. Mark, it's been a pleasure to spend this time with you yesterday and today. And when you come back to town, drop in, and I'm sure I know you'll be back and forth for a while, and Pogo Studio is going to continue, but you'll certainly be missed around these parts.
I will miss it here, but I'll be back frequently, and it is a real pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
My pleasure as well. This is Live and Local here on FM 90.9, broadcasting at 90.9 WYL FM and HD Urbana with translator W293 AF Danville, NPR Classical Music and More for Central Illinois. WYLL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. We're going to go out with a group largely based in Springfield. At least the leader is in Springfield, a physician, as a matter of fact. His name Craig Russo. This is the Craig Russo Latin Jazz Project from their CD Mambo Influenciado. And this is the opening track. I don't know how you pronounce it for sure, but it looks like Ugetsu, as recorded in Pogo Studio by Mark Rubel.